My name's Bubba Norton, and I'm on a journey. I'm looking for some real people. Want to hear some real stories. Want to ask some real questions. Get some real answers. Trying to find some spiritual solutions for chemical problems. This is my podcast. Here I am, keeping it real. Hello, my name is Bubba Norton, and this is my podcast. Here I am, keeping it real. Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward that power and to do certain simple things. There has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of the human resources, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. Once confused and baffled by the seemingly futility of existence, they show the underlying reasons why they were making heavy going of life. Leaving aside the drink question, they tell why living was so unsatisfactory. They show how the change came over them. When many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. And that comes from page 50 and 51 of the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, out of the chapter We Agnostics. And I have my guest today is Andrew. I've seen him a little off and on for a couple years. Really got to know him pretty well the last year. Honestly, I don't know a whole lot about his story. I've heard what he shared in those meetings. And that's the reason I had it on this podcast. My bullshit detector is pretty good. And I can tell when someone has a good story. And more importantly, I can tell when someone has some good sobriety. And he's definitely the type of person I want to have on this podcast. Welcome to the podcast, Andrew.
Hey, thanks, Bub. It's good to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. So we spoke a little bit about beforehand about what we want to try and accomplish here. I think we'll both just get out of the way and let happen what happened. Let's talk a bit. I'm going to turn it over to you, and I want you to talk a little bit about, tell us a little bit of your story, how you your family life, how you got to drinking, and how you ended up in the rooms. Go ahead. All right.
Well, you know, I grew up in an alcoholic family through the 60s and 70s. It was a middle-class family. Both my parents were very well-educated. My father went to Yale. My father was an artist. And then my mother graduated from Miami University. She had a degree in English. And so it was a time that generation drank a lot. I remember as a child, cocktail parties. My father loved martinis. And throughout the years, their drinking changed.
Yeah.
As a child, I was given every example of why not to drink and why not to ever become an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
The early years seemed like there were some good times, some fun, but that quickly changed. You know, I can remember probably being 7 or 8 years old and watching my father go into convulsions and throwing up blood, having some serious issues. There was a lot of fighting, you know, and this was a generation that, you know, they stayed married.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't, you don't throw the flag in.
Right.
You stay married.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I hear people sometimes talk about their divorced families and it was traumatic for them. And then I have to joke with them and say, listen, my parents stayed married. And wow. I was years of therapy trying mm-hmm. to get over it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Never had a good example mm-hmm. of how to be a loving, caring partner.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I didn't know what family I was going to get from day to day.
Mm-hmm.
I had one family from 8 in the morning to 5. And then at 5, after all the drinks started flowing, you know, by 6 or 7, there was a different family.
Sure.
So as a child, I began drinking at a young age.
How old were you?
I would say I was probably 9 or 10.
Wow.
But that would be, we'd go to a friend's house. Their parents would all go out with my parents, and then we'd sneak drinks. I really used the age of 13 as my beginning, because that's when the drinking led to other things.
Mm.
And I remember specifically taking on, you know, other drugs
mm-hmm.
because, hey, alcohol wasn't that bad. I'm not having that bad a problem.
Yeah,
you know, I'm not turning into my dad.
Yeah, yeah.
You're
13. I'm not my dad. Yeah, okay.
And so I'm going to try a little bit of this.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to other things. You know, when you don't get results or negative results right away, you up the ante.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess before I was 15, I started having a lot of repercussions. You know, waking up, wondering how I got home. Before I was 16, I had my first blackout.
Wow.
Drank regularly. I can remember as a child going up to the high school, because everyone congregated at the high school. And they would leave. And I'd go up there on Sunday morning and go through and find bags of empty beer bottles, or there were bags with empty, but there would still be full beers in it.
Mm.
And as a kid, we would drink them. You know, I'd have friends, and we'd go, hey, man, there's 3 in here. Let's start drinking.
Oh, God.
And it was crazy. I look back on it and think, what was I thinking? You know, by the time I was 19, I grew up in Ohio, and it was time to leave. You know, it was time to get thrown out of the nest. And so I left Ohio and moved to Texas. And
Texas?
Well, I had a sister who had already bailed out, because mm-hmm. during this time, there were no jobs in Ohio. You know, and everyone was flocking to Texas because we needed work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the factories and stuff were closing down in Ohio, so I left Ohio, and when I got there, the drinking age was 19,
mm-hmm.
and all the drugs were about half the price. You know, it takes a lot of money to get them 1,300 miles.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I thought I'd just found the promised land.
Sure.
You know, I could go into clubs, and back then they had 50-cent well drinks.
Mm-hmm. What year was this game?
1981.
Yep, that's right when I moved to San Marcos.
Yeah.
I know. Yep.
1981, and I loved drinking liquor mm-hmm. at that age. It made me feel like I was an adult.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact was, but I was 19, really going on about 12 or 13, because of the situation of growing up in an alcoholic family, you never really mature,
mm-hmm.
you know. And these are all things I've come to understand and learn as a person in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So at the early 80s in Houston was just wild, you know. I mean, the music was changing,
mm-hmm.
and there were a lot of clubs. Liquor was cheap, and there was a lot of drugs, too.
X was legal.
Yeah, yeah. X was legal. I forgot about that.
I didn't.
Remember that? It was legal for a while, and then
I can remember going to bars in San Marcos, and they had jars of it. It was like $5 a hit.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally forgot that was legal for a while, and then they made it illegal. Well, also what was coming on the scene was cocaine,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'd actually dabbled in that before I ever left Ohio. And that was one of the things that just grabbed me by the throat,
mm-hmm.
you know. The drinking had gotten to be not fun. I would drink and I would start feeling like sluggish and, oh my God, you know, I don't want to be an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be drunk. So let me do a little bit of this and it'll take that feeling away.
Yep.
And then I would chase that with more liquor.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it was a vicious cycle you jump into.
Yeah.
I don't like feeling drunk. Oh my God, I'm so high. I got to sleep. Let me eat mm-hmm. a Quaalude and mm-hmm. have, you know, some more beer. And that led me down the spiral pretty quickly. But at 21, I landed a really good job, and I thought I'd get my act together.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably one of the best jobs you could have had during that time. We worked hard, we played hard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, during this time, everyone drank. At the end of the day, we would meet down at the end of the cul-de-sac with our boss, and we would all drink.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you couldn't get away with that. And the job I had was with one of the number one express companies.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, drinking hard, and then there was no drug testing.
Mm-hmm.
So we would do chemicals to keep mm-hmm. us going all day.
Mm-hmm.
And I could deliver more packages than anybody. I tell you, it started off being kind of a helper,
mm-hmm.
and then it quickly turned into a habit I couldn't shake.
Yeah.
At 22, I started getting some information about my parents and that they were having health issues, and I'd been with the company about a year, and I came in off the road, and just out of curiosity, I wanted to see if there's any jobs available up there in Ohio, and there was. There mm-hmm. was one 40 miles from my hometown, so I applied for it and got it.
Mm-hmm.
And my father had fallen and broken a rib, and I was going to be the hero. I was going to return home, take care of my parents,
yeah.
And so I packed up. I had a girlfriend at the time I'd met in the club,
mm-hmm.
you know, that should have been a red flag right there. And, so I packed up and moved to Ohio and, was up there about a year, got engaged to the girl I'd moved up there with. And, within 5 or 6 weeks, she decided that she was going to have other relationships. For a kid who's 22, 23, that was devastating.
Sure.
So my drinking skyrocketed.
Mm-hmm.
My drug use, you know, doubled. I thought that was the answer to the emotional pain that I was feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came to terms with that and decided, you know, I'm taking you back to Texas. You're out of here. And I took her back to Texas and came back to Ohio with over a long weekend. And then shortly after that, my mother was diagnosed with cancer. So here I am reeling from a broken heart and drinking and drugging on a regular basis, just trying to maintain. And I learned that I self-medicated,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I think that's what I watched as a child.
Yeah.
You know, we drank when things were good. We drank when things were bad. And so I was there to help take care of my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And the bad thing is that, I would shoot her with Demerol or mm-hmm. Dilaudid for her pain. And then, because I thought I needed to be there and stay up all night, I would turn around, go downstairs, and shoot myself with what other chemical was available to keep me up all night.
Wow.
And
so you're doing intravenous drugs this time?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I started shooting cocaine, and you know, whenever I walked into my parents' house, it was always straight to the fridge to get a beer.
Yeah.
And it was like that as a kid, and it was like that as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And here I was in my early 20s, and I thought that I was just getting ready to have a friendship with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, move beyond that child-parent relationship.
Right, right.
And all this bad stuff started to happen. And it was devastating. Then I met another woman who we met over shots of tequila.
Mm-hmm.
And simultaneously, we looked at each other and reached in our pockets and said, "Hey, you want to do some of this?"
Oh, nice.
And of course, I thought that was like, "Oh my God, I just found the woman of my dreams."
She's got her own cocaine.
She likes to do shots of tequila, and she loves cocaine. This is going to be great. And you can imagine how that turned out.
Yeah.
But that was a relationship that lasted about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly after my mother passed, we'd married and had a son, and moved back to Texas, you know. And this was 1989.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I was able to maintain my job. I was able to transfer and do all these wonderful things that a good job offers you. But I noticed I moved around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every time things would start getting really bad, I would move to a different apartment or a different house.
Mm-hmm.
I was starting to do the geographical cures.
Fresh start.
Yep. I thought, well, you know, if I get into this rental house, we're not going to drink. We're not going to drug.
Uh-huh.
You know, and this is a new start, you know, like a clean slate. And we'd move. And then within a few short weeks, sometimes it might be months, but everything would come back right to where it was, you know, when I quit.
Yeah.
Shortly after that, I took another transfer to Austin. Houston was just getting too crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of gang related stuff in that town, and it was getting ugly, and it was just no place to have a child.
Sure.
And so I moved to Austin and got a promotion, and just things were going good. It was the move that was going to end all moves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
No more geographical cures. This was going to work out great.
Yeah.
You know. And I guess it was probably about 6 weeks before the drinking started up again. And the other chemicals and stuff came right back into play.
Sure.
I've learned it doesn't matter where you go. Whatever your drug of choice was, it's going to be there.
Yeah.
You know, and I learned that I was running from myself. You know, I didn't learn that till 7-8 years later in 98. But as I settled into Austin, you know, I thought things were going really good, got into a house, and once again, the relationship fell apart.
Mm. And you'd been married how long at this time?
Well, it was about 10 years when I got sober, so we were about 7-8 years.
Wow.
And the relationship fell apart. Again, you know, external people came into my ex's life, and I didn't want to let go. I wanted to hold on to it.
Mm.
So, again, self-medicating, thinking that, you know, I just got to hold on for the kids. I got to do this. And that lasted about 3 years. I ended up leaving that job, and with hopes that if I was around more often, you know, I could fix this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can fix this person.
Yeah.
They've got some issues, and if I just, you know, quit this job and only work 30 hours a week and can come home every evening and be available, and she'll come around. And but the problem was is when I left my good job, that left more time to drink.
Oh, man.
I found myself at 9:30 in the morning riding on the tractor, mowing the lawn with a Budweiser in my hand.
Not good.
And, of course, again, wherever you go, everything is there, the alcohol and the drugs. And we ran into some people who were always able to provide. Mm-hmm. And it did not matter whether we wanted it or not. I noticed that we were an extremely codependent relationship. One weekend, I would say, I'm not doing it. Don't bring it home. Mm-hmm. Quit. And at midnight, I'd come home with everything, you know, yeah. Bottled tequila and some cocaine. And then the next weekend, she would say, I'm not doing it. I don't even ask. And then by 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening, I'd call and say, hey, why don't you just go ahead? Go ahead and bring some home. And this went on for a couple years. And I started seeing the writing on the wall. When I would drink, there were nights where I would just go back out on the back deck and sit there after one beer or two beers and just feel this sense of emptiness, this sense of sorrow. And I would just cry.
Yeah.
I was like, what is going on? You know, why am I so unhappy? Why aren't these things making me happy anymore? And there were many nights I sat there and just cried and couldn't figure out why I couldn't fix my life,
yeah.
fix everything around me. And then came February 15th, 1998, and gotten into an argument. I'd taken my son into Austin. We'd watched a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Came back, and I looked up at the restaurant, and I saw her there. And it was early Sunday morning, and I mm-hmm. knew what was going on. So my heart was broken. I dropped my son off. I said, listen, I'm going back to Austin. This is my day. So I went back to Austin, and drank heavy all day.
Mm-hmm.
Went to a restaurant, did a few shots of Patron. Went to another friend's house, drank, and then I was driving around, coming down Exposition, got onto Lake Austin. I was sitting at the red light at Exposition and Lake Austin Boulevard. And by this time, the tequila had really kicked in.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you remember the tunnel vision that would happen, but I was sitting there, and that despair and sadness was just overwhelming. And I'm watching the red light, and I'm listening to, I think it was Bruce Robinson, Angry All the Time.
Uh-huh.
It was a perfect sad song.
Yeah.
to listen to when you're that down. And the light turned green, and I threw it into first gear and started peeling out and fishtailed a little bit. And about that time, that tunnel vision I had opened up. And you know who was sitting beside me?
Not Johnny Law.
The cops.
Oh, man. You're like, what was... You weren't thinking.
I've watched their eyes. Their eyes got as big as silver dollars. And they're like, what is this guy doing? And got about halfway down the block, and the lights went on, and they pulled me over into the Phillips 66 station. And the funny thing is the day before, I'd cleaned out my pickup truck. I'd cleaned out all the beer cans out of the back.
Mm-hmm.
I'd cleaned out all the plastic little...
Corner baggies, yeah.
Paraphernalia. And they got me out, and I knew it was up. I knew the gig was up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a sense of relief, yeah. But fear, you know? Yeah. I was like, thank God. And he says, do you mind if we search your car?
Uh-huh.
And I was like, no, please, uh-huh. Go ahead. You can search my car. I'm just getting a DWI. You know, it was a relief to know that that's all I was getting was a DWI, when mm-hmm. I could have very easily gotten something much more severe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Within an hour or two, I'd got down, was being processed, and then it really started hitting me.
Started sobering up.
The emptiness, that man, this is bad, you know. Yeah. And they fingerprint you and do all this stuff, and I remember walking into the cell and then clanking that door,
mm-hmm.
and the sound of that metal on metal. And the funny thing is I'd prayed for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can remember the late 90s and early 80s saying, man, why can't I stop? Because I wanted to. Mm-hmm. There were plenty of times where I was just like, this life has got to stop. Just drinking, please relieve me of this, whatever this is. Why can't I stop drinking? And right after that door clanked shut, I started seeing these nights and mornings where I actually, you know, woke up praying, going, man, why did I do that again last night?
Mm-hmm.
Please, let, you know, it's like all these prayers started flashing through my head. And I knew that was the moment. I guess, you know, they talk about that moment of clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I had a choice. I was either going to go down the wrong path and be miserable and probably die an alcoholic drug death, or I could get my act together.
Yeah.
And the feeling, you know, they talk about a bottom, and that bottom for me was just such despair, such emptiness, such, you know, surrender, that I was ready.
Yeah.
You know, I'd spent years trying to do it on my own, and I'd never gone to any meetings or anything. I just, you know, I knew that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing was, is I got bailed out. It took all night.
Who bailed you out?
My ex.
Mm-hmm.
She, and it's so funny, the next morning she says, we got home and she said, well, I got a little stuff here if you want to do it. And I was like, I looked at her and I said, man, I just spent the night in jail. Are you crazy?
Yeah.
And then I grabbed it and did it.
Yeah, sure. I've done it. I know that feeling.
And I did the rest of it. And then she went off to work and got the kids off school. And I picked up the phone. And I had a sister who was in recovery.
Okay, that was going to be my question. Yeah. All right.
She'd quit drinking probably in 89.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd moved to to the Austin, Georgetown area in 90, 91. So she had a couple years at least on me. Well, 7 to 8 years on me. But she never, ever talked about recovery
mm-hmm.
or alcoholism. She watched me.
Yeah.
And when I picked the phone up that morning, I called her and I said, Mary, I said, I just spent the night in jail. And she says, really? That's great.
Yeah.
And I was like, huh? I don't think that was great. It was really humiliating. But the tone of her voice was just so enlightened and so happy that I'd gone to jail. And she says, well, I'll tell you what. She goes, why don't you come up to Georgetown and stay with me and my family for a while? And she goes, you know, maybe Friday I'll take you to a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Friday, February 20th, 1998. And so I packed my stuff up that week, suitcase, and that Friday I drove to Georgetown. And went to my first meeting that night.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember walking in and just feeling that sense of belonging.
Yeah.
Everybody was smiling and laughing. And back then they smoked cigarettes. And it just felt right. And I sat down, and then a gentleman named Mike told his story. Well, he was... He talked about being in a self-imposed prison, that every day he would drink and not want to. He had a taxi service that would deliver his booze, and he had other people delivering the other things that he wanted. And he talked about peeking out the blinds, and he was laughing about it. And it'd been a long time since he'd had a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And I just knew that I could relate to that.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of my journey into recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you all right? Go ahead.
I got a cough here.
Go ahead. You're good, bud.
So, after the meeting, we walked out into the hallway. My sister grabbed a book, and she put it in my hand, and she said, go out here and talk to these guys. And I had the book in my hand, and about six or seven guys gathered around me, and they took a pen, and they put their names and numbers in my book.
Nice.
And that was really the beginning of me admitting that I had a problem with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
The first year of recovery was fairly easy because I had so much stuff to clean up right away. I had a DWI, I had a divorce, I had a custody battle. And so dealing with all that didn't let me dig too deep into what the real problem was.
Yeah.
The only time I didn't go to a meeting, I went to a meeting every day. The only time I didn't go to the meeting is when my son had an issue or a parent-teacher thing at school or a sporting event.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so that was really good for me to be in a meeting every day. And then at about a year sober, life hit you.
Mm-hmm.
It hit me. The pink cloud started going away.
Yep.
I had a sponsor. Well, let me rephrase that. I had a couple different sponsors. Mm-hmm. I would work with one person, and then we'd get to the fourth step, and you know, he didn't understand that I took everybody else's inventory. I wasn't taking my inventory,
and he
wanted me to look at me,
uh-huh.
and I was like, well, you don't seem to understand. I'm a little different. I'm not like you other alcoholics.
And
I'd go and start working with somebody else.
Yeah.
But today, all those guys are my best buddies, and they call me when I'm when I least expect it. Usually, mm-hmm. when my head is full of fear and anxiety, and the phone rings, and it's them. But at 1 year sober, I had one of the guys I was working with. He was 13 years sober. Good guy. He heard me speak in a meeting, and I don't know exactly what I said, but it was pretty dark. And he told me, he says, you know, Andrew, I need you to go talk to your general practitioner, tell him the thoughts you're having, and, you know, seek outside help. So at that point, I had to seek some outside help. I got on some Paxil,
mm-hmm.
and then Wellbutrin, mm-hmm. to get me through the depression. And then shortly after that, that sponsor went out.
Oh.
And it was such a good lesson in understanding how cunning, baffling, and powerful this disease is.
Yeah, respect it,
you
know, now.
I remember being at the grocery store and looking over and seeing him with a young girl underneath his arm and a suitcase of Budweiser. And I was like, what is going on here, you know?
Wow.
And I think he eventually got sober. But I understand the fragility of my sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've learned so many lessons. And just like that. At 6 months sober, before things got bad, I got a call from some friends in Houston. And they said, hey, you need to come to Katy and see this guy, and he's in the hospital. And it was someone I'd spent a lot of time with camping and drinking, and he was jaundiced. And so at 6 months sober, I got a perfect example of where I could have ended up.
What's waiting on you, too?
Yeah. What's waiting on me? He lived another 48 hours before he died.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I look back over the years, and whenever I start feeling sorry for myself or thinking things are so bad, I get these little messages.
Yeah.
And I like to call them God shots. I don't mm-hmm. know exactly what they are.
Yeah.
But they remind me that there's something good out there watching over me,
mm-hmm.
and I have access to that if I don't drink and I don't drug and I don't let my selfishness and self-pity get in the way.
Absolutely.
And so throughout sobriety, I've done some moves. You know, I moved up to Connecticut and lived up there for 4 or 5 years.
Where'd you live in Connecticut?
I lived in West Hartford when I left. Mm-hmm. I originally lived in Salem, and then East Lyme, and then West Hartford. And I'd moved up there for a relationship in sobriety. And it was really a great gift that I thumbed my nose at. You know, it's just like, I unfortunately made that individual, made her pay for all the sins that from my former relationship, because I didn't know how to be in a relationship.
Right,
you know,
right.
I was still hurting, and one of my sponsors I had up there, you know, he was such a good guy, Dan. He taught me so much, but I remember him telling me, you know, Andrew, hurt people hurt people.
Yeah.
And you're hurt, and you turn around, you hurt everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's all we know.
Yeah. We hurt the people closest to it, to us. And I remember when that relationship ended, and that was 2006. And I went and talked to my sponsor. I said, I'm leaving. I'm quitting my job and moving back. He says, no, you're not. You've been running your whole life. He goes, I want you to stay here at least a year. So he made me stay.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to stay. I wanted to be healthy. I wanted to be emotionally healthy. And I didn't want to run anymore.
You were getting teachable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I stayed, you know. And I watched this person, you know, get into another relationship. Mm-hmm. And I went to meetings and was able to be there and not, and work through that stuff, you know, that knot in your stomach, like, man, I really screwed this up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I learned that I was, you know, that was me. Mm-hmm. I screwed it up. Mm-hmm. Nobody else screwed it
up. Owned it.
Yeah, I owned it. And I was able to stay there through that whole year and leave on good terms.
Better,
you know. Yeah, it was painful.
Mm-hmm.
And but I'm glad I did it, you know. I've had some really great sponsors. One of the things that I did when I was up there, they had a retreat. It was called the Prodigal Sons Retreat, and that was one of the first times I'd gotten an opportunity to work all 12 steps in 3 days.
Wow.
You know, we'd show up on Friday night and we'd start working, and that really helped. Because I tended to bounce around, you know, from one person to the next when things would get tough. And so that was a lot of growth.
When did you finally do a four step?
Well, I'd done a couple four steps.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say it was probably 2004, 2005. I'd done it officially. And I, you know, went and I made amends to, you know, my ex, and it was a sincere amends. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't, I'm doing this so I feel better.
Yeah.
It was an actual man. Mm-hmm. You know, I could have been more present.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't always there. You know, there were so many things looking back in the past where I realized that, you know, I was only there half-heartedly.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, yeah, I love playing with the kids. I don't want to have anything to do with you.
Yeah.
Forgetting that, you know, adults need love and attention, too.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, that then finally in 2007, I got the opportunity to move back to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I was going on 10 years sober. My life was still financially a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, I was trying to fill it with stuff in relationships. And I'd finally got an opportunity to take care of some financial stuff. I'd gotten a job overseas. And here's another way my higher power works in my life. I got to go to orientation over in Houston. And
orientation for what?
For this job overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a good job. It was going to be... I needed this money, you know. I was still, I mean, I was 10 years sober and still $15,000 in debt from the divorce. And I thought, man, how am I going to be working overseas in Iraq and not have meetings, you know? And I called over, well, I talked to the people in HR, and they said, oh yeah, they have meetings over there and it's going to work out fine. And but once I got over there, that really wasn't the case.
Yeah.
You know, because they're always out running their missions.
Sure.
And people don't show up.
Yeah.
But prior to that, when I were in Houston at orientation, after the first break, I'm standing there and there's three of us talking. And there was one guy who was just kind of an oddball out and didn't fit in to our conversation. And he stepped away, and this guy looked at me and I looked at him, and we're like, are you friends with Bill W?
Oh, wow.
And he's like, yeah, I got like 15 years. And,
oh,
and
man.
I had 10. And we went through orientation, and it was just so good to have somebody who understood that I am in recovery and mm-hmm. I need, you know, fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up being on the plane overseas. We got there, and I ended up in northern Iraq in Balad, and he went to Baghdad, and said, man, well, I hope to see you again soon. And then with 48 hours behind me, I got called in the office, and they said, hey, we're transferring you down to Baghdad.
Oh, wow. There you go. Thank you, God, right?
And this guy was in a hooch, I don't know, 30 yards from me.
Uh-huh.
And we did the whole tour there,
uh-huh.
and I had somebody in the program, somebody to talk to, someone to share all the stuff, the insanity of being over there with.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We're still real close. He just celebrated his sobriety birthday not too long ago, and got in touch with him, and he's doing good. And but that's how my higher power works in my mm-hmm. life. He puts people in my life when I least expect it. And then you know, I've been in situations. I came home, was unable to get work for a while.
Mm-hmm.
It's just about broke. And then I got a job in the oil field.
Wow.
And all these jobs, you know, around people that they work hard and they party hard. When I went into that job in the oil field, I remember saying, how can I be of service to this company?
Yeah.
What can I do, you know, to make it better? And when I started, and that was the program working in me, when I started saying, how can I be of service, instead of, man, what can I get out of this job? Mm-hmm. Are you going to give me more money?
Yeah.
You know, I've got all this experience. When I had a different point of view of just asking, how can I be of service when I show up, wonderful things started happening, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's been my experience throughout my sobriety, is that if I show up with the right attitude, wonderful things start opening up for mm-hmm. me, you know? But when I get into self and selfishness and what can I get out of life, I'm very unhappy, you know. So that has led me down the road to more transportation jobs. Today, when I left the oil field, I'd been there about 7 years, worked my way up into management, thinking that, you know, I need to be in management because I'm such a good manager.
Right.
Look how well I've managed my life. And I learned quickly that I am not management material, and I was really unhappy, you mm-hmm. know. Some days it's a struggle for me just to take care of me,
yes.
you know, and when you're in management, you're taking care of a lot of other people's
mm-hmm.
problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned that people present themselves one way
mm-hmm.
and say, oh, yes, I'll do whatever you ask. Mm-hmm. I can do that. Oh, that's the job description? I can handle that.
No, yeah.
And then come to find out 4 weeks later, once they're on the payroll, they're unwilling to perform and do the stuff. And I couldn't handle it anymore. And so I left there. And it's funny because I left there with no prospects. And one of the things that has always been present in my life is music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've used music as my medicine.
Mm-hmm.
It's always helped me. And I've always wanted to be a part of it. And so now I get back, I'm unemployed. People are asking me, what do you really want to do? And I said, well, I think I'd like to drive a tour bus for a rock band.
Now, have you ever driven a bus before?
No.
You never drove a Prevost?
No, no.
So,
yeah.
That's so odd. Yeah. You know?
I've driven everything else. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, tankers and mm-hmm. just any type of vehicle you can imagine. But I'd never driven a tour bus. And but I said, I want to drive a tour bus for a rock mm-hmm. band. And I just put it out there. And I talked to certain people.
Mm-hmm.
And before you know it, I'm driving a tour bus for a rock band.
That's
and
unbelievable.
I'm around drinking and partying on a regular basis. And I look at it and I go, man, better them than me.
Yeah.
Because I know that stuff quit working for me a long
mm-hmm.
time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm able to be around it. Could I have done it at 5 years sober? Doubt it. 10 years sober?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But at 20 years sober, I think I had a good connection. And mm-hmm. And I don't believe that would have been put in my lap
mm-hmm.
had the strength not been there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, today that's what I do. You know, I drive a tour bus for a band and it's really fun, you know. I want to step back. When I was in Austin and life was really starting to fall apart, I remember wanting to go out and hear some music. And this is when I really knew I had a problem. I went and got tickets and went down to La Zona Rosa to see one of my favorite bands. And it was a local band, but we got down there and we weren't there 15 minutes. And I'd started consuming alcohol and other things, and I couldn't even stay through the opening band. I had to get home and start doing all the other stuff that I
yeah.
did, all the drugs.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, man, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was probably 92, 93.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I didn't get sober till 98. But when it took grip of me and wouldn't even let me enjoy a night of good, great music
yeah.
and watching people perform, I knew I had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, today I get to see all the music I want, hear all the music I want, and I really gravitate towards a lot of musicians who are in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so funny how there's a lot of older music that, you know, when I was out there that I listened to that were performed by people in recovery, and I didn't hear the message.
Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't ready.
Steve Earle sobered me up, man.
Yeah.
I'm telling you.
I mean, I went and saw him at the Backyard in 98. I think it was April. And
he'd just gotten out of rehab pretty much.
He'd just gotten out of prison.
Yeah.
And I heard that. I went home with the CD and put the headphones on. I think we had Walkmans back then still.
Mm-hmm.
And I was laying in my little futon. And I heard that song, CCKMP.
Oh.
Cocaine Cannot Kill My Pain.
That's your song, huh?
And I was just like, oh, somebody understands.
When you hear him sing that song, you don't have any doubt that he lived it.
Yeah.
You know, heroin and cocaine. I think it was the heroin more. But he vacillated between the two. And mm-hmm. when he's singing that song, if you're a recovering addict or alcoholic,
you
feel it.
And, you know, Stevie Ray, all his songs were so, you know, based on his recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I would listen to him, I had no clue.
Yeah. And when you're in recovery and you hear him, like, walking a tightrope.
Yeah.
You go, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you hear it, man.
One of the first things my sister did when I moved to Georgetown was she handed me a CD by a guy named Stephen Bruton.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not breaking his anonymity because mm-hmm. we lost him to throat cancer. He's such a great human being.
Mm-hmm.
He played guitar for Bonnie Raitt, played for Chris Christopherson.
Wow.
I think the deck out at the Saxon Pub is named the Bruton Deck.
Oh, really?
Like that. But Stephen, she handed me his CD and I listened to it. And one of his songs is "It Is What It Is," and some of the lyrics are, "I was a monster without a sponsor, like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I was a goner. I was a loner. And when my mixture was right, hell, I'm a nice bunch of guys.
And, I'm a nice bunch of guys.
Yeah. And I could so relate to that, you know. And I followed him throughout the rest of his career. And there's so much else, you know. I just, so much other music that carries me through. I'm in recovery. I'm not a really good reader.
Mm-hmm. You know?
It's tough for me to sit down and sit still that long.
Mm-hmm.
So I really love the audio part. I remember one night in Georgetown when life was really falling apart, and I wanted to see my sponsor, and I showed up at the White House and he wasn't there, and a guy showed up and said, "Hey, where's your sponsor?" And I go, "I don't know, I'm supposed to meet him here." And he goes, "Well, I got this tape for him, will you give it to him?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Okay." And it was a guy named Mickey Bush,
mm-hmm,
out of California. And if you ever get an opportunity, listen to Mickey Bush.
Okay.
He's great. Mm-hmm. He is so funny.
You're the one that turned me on to Travis Meadows. So yeah, I'm going to be definitely remembering these names, man.
Yeah, Mickey Bush is a speaker. And I took that cassette and I got in my truck and I listened to it. And I was really in a bad place, a dark place, and I listened to that Mickey Bush speaker tape, and it just changed my life.
Mm.
I mean, it made me laugh at my insanity, but also know how deadly my insanity is.
Right.
And he's a great speaker, and I ended up getting that cassette to my sponsor. But how does that happen? You know, when you're in such a bad place and you just want to give up, and someone hands you a speaker tape that turns you around, you know,
absolutely.
And and most recently, you know, a friend of mine turned me on to Travis Meadows, and he is just, his songs are just amazing.
Oh,
you know, I listened to that Killing Uncle Buzzy CD, and he's said that CD was never really meant to be a release.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually a writing he did for his therapist.
Yeah.
You know, it was not intended to be. And then afterwards, it's like, man, this is some good stuff.
And let's, there's three or four songs on there I welled up
because
I just lived them. I lived that one, learning how to live alone again.
Mm-hmm.
I lived that.
And that song in God Speaks.
Ooh.
I mean, tears roll down my cheeks to this day every time I hear it.
One time, Travis Meadows was live on Facebook, and I looked down the screen, and I saw you, and I was, oh, there's Andrew. But anyway, I'd heard God Speaks, and I thought, oh, that's such a cool song. But that night on that live feed, he said, everyone thinks this is a love song. He goes, it's not. This is the people during the meetings. God speaks to me through them. So it's a love song, but it's a different type of love. It's a love for the people in those meeting rooms, because I have no doubt that's how God speaks to me.
Yeah.
And man, that made that song 10 times better for me. And it's a great song. I'm pestering him on Facebook Live all the time to come on his podcast.
Oh,
I'm going to get him on. I'm a persistent son of a bitch, man. Yeah. You watch. I'll get Travis on here. So tell me, we were talking a little bit ago about some of the codependency issues. I know very little about that. I have no doubt that I have some of those issues. I grew up in a family of alcoholics, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how has that aided your sobriety? Some, has it made your life, your sober life? Do you attend Al-Anon meetings, or you look into them?
I have in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't recently.
Mm-hmm.
When I lived in Connecticut, I had a great sponsor. His name was Dan. And, you know, he knew what I needed.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of those sponsors that didn't talk soft around you. He held the mirror up. He called you on your stuff and would never let you get away with anything. And I would share a lot about my upbringing and my family. And he said, you know, you need to go to Al-Anon. And I went to Al-Anon, and he also said you need to go to Adult Children of Alcoholics.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got, you know, I got into Adult Children of Alcoholics, and I learned so much from both those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and today it's mostly AA. It's mm-hmm. all AA, actually.
Yeah.
But I needed those at a point in time mm-hmm. in my life to give me an understanding of what formed me?
Yeah.
Why did I behave the way I behaved? And what role did I have in it? And mm-hmm. sometimes there I did have a role, and other times I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you need to understand that.
Yeah.
You know, at some point you may be a victim until you understand, you know, you cannot be a victim anymore.
Yeah, yeah. You know? At some point you don't understand why you're seeking out the relationships you do or the motivation for them, right?
Yeah.
And then you don't know how well, because we never really learned how to have a relationship.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
We learned by watching, you know, our parents and stuff. And we learned by growing up around functioning alcoholics, right? And, you know, and, you know, I can remember this day, always tiptoeing around eggshells. I didn't want to set my dad off. Or my mom, my dad would get angry. My mom would get, you know, just depressed.
Yeah.
And either one of those were like murder to me. And it's like we were saying earlier, he said, you were the fixer, Bubba. And I was going, yeah, because when my dad was going off, it was my job in my mind to keep my brother and sister. Everything's going to be all right. Everything's going to be all right. You know, trying to make them happy and stuff. And you never see how that creeps into your relationships going forward. Until someone's able to adequately point it out for me. Can't you see what you're doing?
Yeah.
You know, why don't you let them be them?
Yeah.
You know, and it's pretty eye-opening, man.
Yeah. One of the things I noticed in dysfunctional alcoholic relationships is there's usually one person who's very, you know, calm, cool, gets drunk, goes along with everything, and then mm-hmm. there's the mean agitator.
Oh yeah.
And they're just back and forth. And in my family, my father was the cool, laid back, drunk, fall asleep, cigarette mm-hmm. in his hand, burned the chair, and, you know. And then my mother, on the other hand, was angry all the time.
Mm.
And I think she was angry because she, you know, she was intelligent,
mm-hmm.
smart.
Mm-hmm.
And there she ended up in a relationship with an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And kind of gave up, and instead of leaving, decided to join him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have this, you know, if you're ever mean to me, I am not going to put up with this. You
yeah.
know, I'm going to, you know, treat me like my mother treated my father. And,
mm-hmm.
and that's what you say on the outside. But then when it comes right down to it, you just cower down.
Yeah.
Because you want to be, you want everything to be peaceful and quiet.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you don't
yeah.
want to, you know, to make waves. And
and you don't know how to be, you have to learn. And I think everyone has to learn that. You have to learn how to really be honest
mm-hmm.
without the real intention being to hurt someone back.
Yes.
Learn how to be honest saying, look, this is not acceptable to me or this bothers me. I might even be wrong. That it bothers me, but I'm just letting you know it bothers me, you know, and not have your attention to bring any type of emotional harm to somebody else. It's really about, I need to make myself understood here.
Yes.
You know, and we don't know how to do that.
No, not at all.
We don't have a clue how to do that. Who, tell me, what's been the most impactful thing on your sobriety? What do you think? Because I know, for me, there's like two or three events in my life. One was Steve Earle's song, God is God. Whenever I say that song, pulled a pistol out of my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Pulled a pistol out of my mouth. And you talked about it a while ago about had a moment of clarity. I mean, that night when I heard that song, there was a little voice went off inside of my head. And someone says it's God. I just say it's like my inner self, where I was able to silence all the other bullshit in my life. And I heard that lyric, every day on earth, another chance to get it right. I received the blessing.
Yeah.
And right then I had a moment of clarity and that voice said, Bubba, you're not gonna kill yourself. You don't have the balls to kill yourself. You can't take a drink, you can't take a drug, you're tired of hurting. What are you gonna do?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mentioned that moment of clarity. That was getting me into sobriety. That was the beginning of my sobriety. Now later on, when my relationship ended in Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
that was the second bottom.
It hurts, and you're like, man, I can't drink and I can't drug over it. What I'm going to do, because I do not like how I feel.
I was sitting in a parking lot at a mall.
Mm-hmm.
And the upheaval of emotion, I was, at that point, I was crying over the loss of my mother, mm-hmm. my father, who had mm-hmm. died years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was crying over the loss of my sister, who was in recovery, but we lost her to cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So,
is that the one that helped you initially?
Yes.
Oh, Andrew.
So, you know, I lost her in 2003.
And how many brothers and sisters did you have?
I have one brother and one sister.
So at this time, you only have a brother left, right? Yeah. So your whole family's gone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Keep going, sorry.
And so this was 2006, 3 years after my sister passed away. And I just destroyed a relationship that was probably, next to sobriety and my son, the best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting in the mall just freaking crying, and I realized that this is what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
All those years of you know, holding that stuff in and not acknowledging it and being with it,
mm-hmm.
Being okay with it, or just at least acknowledging it and saying it's okay to be sad.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was crying over the loss of all these people in my life, and I was trembling. I was I mean, my arms were shaking. It was the strangest thing and the saddest thing I've experienced. And I picked up the phone, and still we had cell phones at the time. I went for work, and I called my sponsor, and he's just like, "Are you okay? Can you drive? Do I need to come get you?" And he talked with me for about 15, 20 minutes while I was, you know, heaving and hoeing and crying, and he talked to me until I was calm enough, and I said, "No, I can make it to your house. I can make it to your house." And I drove, and he spent that afternoon and evening with me, and that was just a moment in sobriety where I think spiritually and emotionally I grew.
Yeah,
you know,
that's when you realized, probably, or I know I had similar moments when you go, drinking and drugs aren't the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the problem. I don't know, I can't put my finger on it yet, but it's right here.
Yeah.
Right? And now you know this is what we got to go to work on.
Yeah.
It's another surrender.
Exactly. And you know, and I said it's a bottom. It's another bottom. And mm-hmm. I think that throughout someone's sobriety, if you're growing, you're going to have another bottom.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, I relate it to, you know, the butterfly in the cocoon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whenever you emerge from one point in your life to another, it's usually pretty painful.
It's not, the metamorphosis is painful, man.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I think that's what we're doing constantly.
I think you're right.
And if you're not, then you're probably numbing yourself with something.
And you know,
not getting any spiritual or emotional growth.
Because I was talking to you, you know, my struggles with this God concept.
Mm.
That's the same thing I'm going through. I cannot make myself believe that there's not a God. But my frustration level with this God dude is through the roof. And, you know, the benefit from it is I've learned so much through my study of Buddhism and about the nature of the problem for me. But at the same time, I can't make myself deny the existence of God.
Right.
And I know as long as I continue with the struggle, and it is painful, I know if I continue with that struggle, that metamorphosis is going to come.
Yeah.
But I can't do it off of what Andrew says, or John, my sponsor, says, what my beautiful wife says, what my dad says.
Right.
It's got to be something. What my old pastor that I had on his podcast, what he says, it's got to be something that there's going to have to be some revelation and acceptance, and I'm looking for it, but it ain't there yet. But I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I tell people all the time, I don't regret it. I don't fight it, because I know when I get there, the juice is worth the squeeze. You know what I mean? Because then I'm going to have something that's truly mine, you know, and it's not going to be all some cute saying that someone read on Facebook, you know,
right.
It's going to be, no, this is true for me, you know? So I know exactly what you're talking about. Who do you think, and I'm going to put the your sister at the top of that list, who do you think's had the biggest impact on your sobriety? Sounds like your sponsor up in Connecticut.
Yeah, yeah. You know, my sister, of course. But Dan had the most impact on me growing.
Mm-hmm.
Because he would never let me, you know, he pointed out, you know, the selfishness and the self-pity.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to talk about this in meetings about self-pity. Whenever someone would tell me, you know, you're in self-pity, I would say, no, I'm not. I'm not feeling sorry for myself. You know, just life is unfair.
Yeah. That's such an alcoholic statement. Yeah. I'm not feeling sorry for myself. Life just ain't fair.
it took me many years to understand that self-pity was under the umbrella of selfishness.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I looked at it as two different things, and it's like, no. It's, you know, it's A, underneath selfishness, and, you know, it just...
Well, there's that word self. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it was 2012 or 2013, right? And I first came into rooms in 87. And I'm a slow learner. I really am, because I'm only focused on what I'm wanting to pay attention to. And all this other information is just going around me all the time. I'm just, for whatever reason, man, I'm just a dumbass. I don't know, I can't pick it up. And my current sponsor was at my gym training one time. And he was, I was working him out. I used to do like personal training with him. So anyway, and I was whining about something. And he, as he does, he thumped me on the chest with his finger. And he said, relieve me of the bondage of self. That's in the third step prayer. Read it sometime. And you know what? I'd never heard that line like that before. And this was like 24 or 25 years that I'd been in a room. But then you see that, you start to understand just how all-encompassing that bondage of self is.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you start to see, you know, self-pity is just, it's another act of just thinking about yourself, right? Which is the nature of our problem, man.
You know, I was talking earlier about how it's so difficult for me to sit and read. And that's what I love about the Big Book and my progress in recovery is that, you know, early on, I just read the words and maybe not quite understood them, but I just read them because I knew that's what I was supposed to do. And then, you know, at 5 years sober, you read the same thing and this light comes on. And then at 10 years sober, you read the exact same thing and a brighter light comes on.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, man,
depends where you are,
doesn't
it? Yeah, it depends where you are at that time. Because I've read books years ago that had a huge impact on my life. And I read them now and I'm meh, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not because I already know the message. It just depends what's going on. That's why, you know, I loved Akshay Nanavati's book, Nirvana. Because that's all he talked about. And in this, my study of Buddhism, you know, about the nature of self and my ego and letting it control and drive all my thoughts without me being aware of it. I need this. I want that. I need you to act this way. Or living in the past all the time. I'll never recover from that, you know, and rehashing all those memories. And then to pick up his book and have him describe how our brain works, how our memory pulls up stuff from time to time, and hear it described scientifically was mind-blowing to me. And I tell you that whole story to tell you that that is nothing that I would have gravitated to 2 years ago, right? But it's just all the stuff going off in my mind now, and all of a sudden, bam, it's earth-shaking information. Yeah. So it all depends what's going on in your life, right?
You're ready to accept it.
Yeah.
Or receive it.
Yeah, you're ready because you're looking for it.
Yeah.
And we don't get there until we get to that point like you're in Connecticut, in that parking lot, right?
Yeah.
Because when we first, when I first sobered up, I was like, man, I don't give a shit about all that. I just don't want to take a drink.
Yeah.
Right? And then you spend some time dry, but your life's really not much better. Then all of a sudden you have a need. Oh, that's why we got to do these steps. That's why I've got to do this, you know? And yeah, it becomes a whole lot more life-saving. I had a similar experience. You know, where we are right now, I didn't do a four-step. I didn't want to. And I didn't take a drink or a drug for 2.5 years. Didn't go to a meeting. Did not know how screwed up my life was. Really didn't. Got out of another relationship. Sound familiar? All heartbroken. Said, what am I going to do? And I called my dad, who sobered up 5 years before me. He goes, won't you go to a meeting? And I was like, well, there's a good idea. You know, and I go to a meeting. Long story short, I meet this guy. And he came up to me. And he asked me who I was, what I was doing there, explained it. And then the whole time I'm telling the story, he's sitting there shaking his head, right? And then he asked me his question. He goes, did you go to college? And I said, well, hell yeah, I went to college. I graduated. He said, good, you know how to write. He knew I didn't do that four step, right? He ended up being my sponsor. And then 2 years after that, within 100 yards of where we're sitting right now, he, Charlie, who was my sponsor, here, he lived in Wembley. And he called me and he said, hey, I want you to come pick me up. We're going to go to a speaker meeting. So I pulled into his driveway, which is literally right across the street. This is 1991. I remember like yesterday, there's an ambulance sitting there. And he had just died. Oh. And he had a heart attack. And while he was dying, he called 911. 911 got to him before I did, right? And, man, that's when I made the worst decision in my life. I didn't go out, but I remember leaving that night going, I'll never get another sponsor. Mm. Right? And I didn't. And it wasn't very honoring of him, that decision, because I started to drift away from the program right then, immediately, right? Which was what led to all my problems leading up to meeting Charlie, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, but that's whenever I made a decision, you know, I just started drifting from the program. But the pain, I think once we sober up and we get removed from it, we find out actually what's really bothering us, right? Whenever, because think about it, Andrew, how young were you when you had your first blackout when you were 15? You never learned how to deal with shit. We don't know what it was to hurt, you know? When I got off those pain pills, and I'm going through similar experiences as you. Now I'm going through a divorce. I just lost my job. I had a felony possession charge, right? And I'm overwhelmed. And then I'm like, oh, shit, what are these? Oh, those are some friggin' feelings, man. You know what I mean? And then I had to learn quick how to deal with that. And got a crash course in that stuff, man. You know, it's just...
Yeah, one of the things Dan used to tell me is because I talk about feelings, you know, and he would say, I'd say, how do I deal with this? And he goes, Andrew, they're feelings. They're meant to be felt. If
that's
you
so
were supposed
true.
To deal with them, uh-huh. They'd be called dealings.
And, I'm going to remember that.
Learning to sit
mm-hmm.
through that uncomfortableness has been such a gift, but it's also still the most, one of the worst things I still struggle with.
You know,
no one likes to feel uncomfortable.
Mm-mm.
He pointed out to me after that relationship that, you know, Andrew, you might be single the rest of your life. You may never get
that was
into
a big fear, wasn't it? Yeah.
And I was so angry at him for that and really just didn't talk to him for a long time. I was mad. And you know, you were talking about Travis Meadows' song, Learn How to Live Alone.
Mm.
That's why I cry every time I listen to it. But I just had to learn to be by myself, you know.
Yeah.
If there's a... something I can tell anyone who's, you know, new in recovery, it's like, you know, relationships will come. God will put people in your life or mm-hmm. those relationships will come if you're healthy.
Yeah.
You know, I want stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, and usually it's stuff I don't need or aren't things that aren't good for me.
Right.
Because that's the selfishness, self-centeredness, mm-hmm. and learning to live alone and be okay in my own skin and learn to be okay when I'm uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a gift, you know. Wish it wasn't uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were talking about the G word, the God word, and mm-hmm. I wanted to share with you something
sure.
that I heard early on in Georgetown. We used to do what we called a wanderers group, and every Wednesday night we would do a meeting at someone else's house.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the guys, he used the sun as his higher power
mm-hmm.
because he grew a cacti and he grew all these exotic plants, and he couldn't quite grasp the whole higher power thing, but every morning he watched his plants go from facing this direction to following the sun and facing that direction. And he said, there's a power that is causing these plants to grow and to go from here to there, to, you know, change positions all day long.
Mm-hmm.
That's power greater than me.
Wow.
And that's my higher power.
Wow.
So, mm-hmm. you know, I try to share that with people.
Sure.
You know, there's something out there.
Mm-hmm. I can't deny that.
Yeah. And it's also just good and evil.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
I try to, when I do good, I feel good and good things happen.
Mm-hmm.
When I don't do anything, usually bad things start happening.
There we go.
And I get real complacent.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned not to do bad things, but sometimes doing nothing, like not going to meetings or picking the phone up and talking to someone else in recovery,
mm-hmm.
is a bad thing.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I see a lot of meetings, so I know you're following that advice, and I always notice, and I'm always glad to see when I get there you're at that newcomers meeting,
mm-hmm.
and I'll never forget that night. That's when I knew that you were somebody I wanted to get to know better. Is that night they had me come speak at the newcomers meeting, and there was a vet in the back of that room, and he came in, and I think it was his first meeting. And they asked if there was anybody there for his first meeting. And he raised his hand. He started crying a little bit. And man, my heart tugged for that guy. I don't know what it is. But when that meeting was over, I looked up and I saw him with you. Hmm. And right away I went, he's in good hands, Bubba.
No.
He's in good hands. You don't have to worry about him anymore. If it's meant to be, he wants it here. There's not a better person in the room he could be with. All right, last question. I always like asking this one. What would you tell somebody sitting down with you and they've been there 2 weeks? What would advice you got for the ultimate newcomer?
Wow, that's a tough one.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much to tell them. You know, I can remember my sister saying, don't quit before the miracle happens. But really, someone this close, you know, just a couple weeks in would be just keep coming
yeah.
to the meetings and sitting. And don't look for, you know, the differences.
Mm-hmm.
Just come in and sit down and things will change. You know, they don't often change for the better right away.
Mm-hmm.
But they have in my life, they've gotten better. So just keep coming in and sitting down and listening, and you will hear some similarities,
mm-hmm.
and it will happen, you know, but it won't happen if you don't come in.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to come in and sit down and be willing.
Yeah. And they got to understand that you can't go in there and walk out,
mm-mm.
and your life ever be the same.
Yeah. I never had a problem walking into a bar at mm-hmm. 3:00 in the afternoon and leaving at 2:30 in the morning.
Right.
you can afford 55 minutes to sit and listen to somebody.
Yeah.
You know, it never bothered me at all to disappear for 7 or 8 hours into a dark room and consume Budweiser until I was sick.
Yeah.
So 55, 60 minutes, I think I can do it, and I think you should too.
There we go, folks. Andrew, thanks for showing up, man. We'll put this out here in probably about a week.
I appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
What
a gift.
We needed to hear your story, and I want people to hear your story. That's what this podcast is all about, man. Sometimes we can't get to a meeting, and we got somebody with some good sobriety. It's with a click of a button.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We can get something we needed. All right, man. We're going to wrap this thing up. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Thanks to Andrew again, and we'll be back to see you real soon. And there you have it. Andrew has left the building. I want to thank Andrew for coming on to Here I Am, Keeping It Real. First time I met Andrew, I think I've been noticing him coming in and out for a couple of rooms now, but I know this. He's one of the people that whenever he started to speak, he's somebody I started to listen to. I've been going to the same group for several years now. And after a while, you get to the point where you know what everyone's going to say. So we're always excited when someone like Andrew, who has so much to offer, is in there and he's contributing. And it's been a blessing to have him around. Remind y'all again, we got a website, bubbanorton.com. I'm going to ask y'all a favor. If you know of any good speakers out there or people who've got a good story, contact us through the website. I'd love to get them on here. I'm looking for one a week. And until then, we'll be right here keeping it real. Thanks, guys.